Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome back to Overnight America. I am looking forward to our next guest. He's someone we check in periodically, and it seems to be one of those topics that it's just fun to talk about, but in practice, it is a terrible business idea, and that is the Del Mar Loop trolley. And it looks like there may have finally stuck a fork in it. Let's join our friend, our watchdog, Tom Sullivan. Thank you for coming on to KMOX.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
That's what I'm wondering about. There's been a couple of meetings, and as of late, it seems like this thing is not getting any support. Does it look like they're going to finally stick a fork in this thing?
Well, you never know. These things have a way of resurrecting themselves, but I would say at this point, things do not look good, at least from the from a standpoint of public dollars. You know, there's talk about trying to get private contributors, but I don't know who would want to put any money in it at this point. So the big question now is what's going to happen, and nobody really has an answer.
You know, you have had your opportunity to stand in front of the Bi-State Board of Commissioners. You were able to lay your case out, and you've been probably the most vocal of those over the last couple of years as the trolley was first an idea, the question of it leading up into where we are today. So they have heard plans of trying to take over management of this loop trolley. And as it sounds like right now, the commissioners are giving it a thumbs down. The St. Louis County executives say, we don't want to put more money into this thing. When you stand in front of the commission, I got to play a little ignorant to all of this. Do they ever have counter questions for you, or do you just give a statement and you're done with your time?
They usually do not, but they do listen. I will say that, because some of the things I might mention will be brought up in the discussion. So they do pay attention to what it is you're saying. The board has changed quite a bit down there in recent years. Most of these boards are usually political people who are put on there basically to go along with the program. And that's the way Bi-State's been run for years. But in recent years, it has changed. They've gotten two commissioners from Madison County who have been asking a lot of questions and demanding that things be done in the open. One commissioner's name is Justin Zimmerman. The other is Derek Cox. So they have been pretty firm in keeping things open.
You know, one of the arguments now that we've heard is that we're so close to breaking even on this thing, so why give up on it now? That made me laugh, number one, because, I mean, we're $52 million in the hole and we're asking for more, so I don't know where you mean break even at this point. I don't see this thing or foresee this thing, even if there were to get some revival, ever breaking even. I mean, if we're talking about, what, $1 million extra a year the thing would need? I don't know how you're going to make that up.
Well, that's what I told the board on Friday. If this was just a question of, you know, you're even 70% there or 80% there, this thing is not even 10% when it comes to ticket revenue. And the question is, what reason is there to believe it's ever going to improve? And there isn't any. One of those examples I gave was in October. There was an October Saturday afternoon where it was 65 degrees and sunny. It was like a picture-perfect afternoon. And Elliot Davis was there doing a story, and the first trolley that came along had three people on it. And the second one that came along had none.
Yeah.
It's not unusual to see the trolleys operating with not a single passenger on it. So how anybody could believe that somehow this is going to improve, I don't know. Joe Edwards is still, I don't know sometimes what he's thinking, but he has actually said he thinks he could take it up to 300,000 passengers a year if it ever got to be running right. But I have a hard time believing that.
No, he would have to include all the people stuck behind it in their own personal cars to make that number viable. And yeah, they're still out there trying to fight this thing. I just don't see it. And I think most people have finally come to the realization that, you know, we gotta wake up. And those that have been some pretty strong proponents of it and have enjoyed the idea of it, I don't think could justify the practical use of it. And, you know, even if you go back to that argument saying that, oh, it's so close to breaking even, you know, it's more of a novelty thing. It's only 2.2-mile track that doesn't really, it's not intended for mass transportation. So it's like, let's say this was something that was a mass transportation. If it was something that was all through out St. Louis and there was a lot of people using it and it actually had a public good, this would be a different story. Like, this is not one of those instances.
No, and that's why some of what Talby Roach was saying, he's the Bi-State CEO, was saying how they were going to incorporate it into the Bi-State system. It's like, this is something entirely different than what you're operating as far as public transit goes. This thing just putt-putts down Delmore about 10 or 15 miles an hour. You know, when people are using transit to go somewhere, you want to get there as quickly as you can. This thing just moves very slow, and then of course it breaks down. That's been another issue. I think you've had some experience with that.
Oh yeah, multiple times. And if it's not the breakdown, it's the, oh, there's a car parked over the line, so now we got to call someone to help spot, make sure we don't hit the car, and then, you know, there's a delay for something like that, and the cars are backed up forever behind this thing. And you can just see the frustration. The frustration is just always there. I don't know if I've ever came across someone in a vehicle that wasn't frustrated with the way this trolley operates when it's in their sight. So I wanted to talk about something else too. As the trolley got to the end of the line, there's one side, which is the Missouri History Museum. The other side was the library that was right there in the Delmar Loop. And you were pointing out there were some interesting things that happened at that library, and just recently they got into some trouble. Is that the same library, or am I mixing them up?
No, that's the University Library. Well, here you have to realize is that we were involved in litigation for nearly 5 years. Is that when they put the plans together for the trolley, it was only supposed to go to Kingsland. Well, the library is on the other side of Kingsland, and then on the other end, it was only supposed to go to Lindell, and of course it went over Lindell and then went into the History Museum. So, you know, that was one of the issues all along with this, and one of the problems with this whole project is that you never were really told the whole story. Things kind of got revealed as they went along. You know, for example, we didn't hear anything about the fact that there wasn't going to be any air conditioning. That just sort of came up later on, mm-hmm. And then there was supposed to be, the big selling point was there was not going to be any overhead wires. Well, all of a sudden, yeah, we're going to need overhead wires, and of course, the really comical thing is it's supposed to be environmental friendly. Well, in addition to stopping up traffic and having cars island trying to get by it, they had to cut down 124 trees to make way for the trolley wires. Mm-hmm. So this has just been deception from the very beginning, and I think it even continues.
Yeah, you know, what I was alluding to on the opposite end, the stop at the U City Library, was some of their different, they were fined recently for not disclosing a couple of things. That's what I was trying to talk to you about, because that's another controversy that's going on.
That's something else, yeah. The University City Library was caught spending public money for a ballot proposal property tax increase last year, and the Missouri Ethics Commission found them to have violated the law, and they fined them for $1,100. There was also a related group also involved in the campaign, and they were fined for $1,100 because they were not reporting their expenditures. Basically, you had a full-fledged campaign for a property tax increase, and nobody was filing any reports as required by the Ethics Commission.
Yeah, people love it when their property taxes go up. No one ever has said that. Yeah, so you got to stay on top of these things, and you know the you don't like when you find out some of these things were not done properly.
Well, that's been an issue throughout all of this area, is that government's spending public money to promote tax hikes, to promote bond issues, and they say, well, this is just for informational purposes only. Well, there is no such exemption in the law, and the problem is the prosecutors have never really enforced the law. The only one I've ever really done so in recent times was D. Joyce Hayes, who was the St. Louis Circuit Attorney, but none of the other ones have done anything. Bob McCullough never did a single thing to enforce the law. So I mean, it's just when you allow them to do that, it just keeps going on and going on. And some of the things are pretty awful. I mean, you're talking about $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 being spent on some of these campaigns.
Mm. You know what I wonder? Some of the drivers, the ones that were driving the trolley, they were some of the nicest people. I'll give them credit. They hired some great people that were operators. I think they still wake up in a cold sweat at night where the doors aren't closing properly and the thing's stuck, and there's about 500 people stuck behind them right in the Del Mar Loop. If I were an operator, I'd still have those nightmares. Man, that
happened
all the time.
You're right. They were very nice people. I mean, there is no question about that. You do feel bad at the fact that they lost their jobs. They gave them some kind of a settlement. I don't know how much it was, but hopefully they'll be able to find other work.
We're going to find out very soon what the next step will be for this, if they cannot revive it, or if it's going to be on an intermediate or at least a long-term pause to try to delay if they do have to negotiate with the federal government. And I'm still a little bit leery on that. So, because we can look at what happened in California with their high-speed rail. They took money from the government. Now, that was a blow-up, and they never even finished the project. So that's a whole different story. But yeah, I can't see negotiations going on with the federal government where we'd have to be required to repay a large majority of this thing. If anything, they might negotiate no repayment if they just want to keep this on a let's try to revisit this in the future type of.
Well, the two issues that we've had is, number one, is it going to have to pay the money back? And as far as anybody can tell, it isn't very likely that that's going to happen. Then the second issue they raised is this would have an impact on future federal funding. Well, that's just kind of like a red herring, because there was a county council committee hearing last week, and Ernie Trakas was really drilling Talby Roach on this. He says, "Can you name one federal official who said anything about this to you that it would hold back, it would cause federal funding to be held up?" He, of course, could not come up with a single person. And then at the bi-state meeting on Friday, you had the regional administrator for the Federal Transit Administration there, and he was asked again, "Can you name any project?" And he said, "Well, we can't really name one, but there was one we almost went to court on." So, I mean, that's just basically been something they've been trying to use to pressure the board to go with Talby Roach's revival plan.
You know what I hope? This would be awesome if it played out this way. It would be a blessing in disguise. Let's say the federal government is looking to pitch some money in for this one high-speed bullet train thing they want to do between St. Louis and Kansas City. There's other states like Columbus and wants to do in Ohio, and they want to put this bullet train in. And we're talking about billions of dollars to put this train in. And I'm thinking to myself, man, wouldn't that be great if we were disqualified for that? Just because of what happened with the loop trolley, it would be such a blessing to not have to worry about wasting a bunch of money on that, too. And then it would be like, wow, we just saved ourselves a ton of cash and hassle in the future. This thing keeps, you know, paying itself off. This is great.
And don't forget the Hyperloop.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the Hyperloop. That's what it's
okay.
Called. Yeah, I kept the bullet train. I called it something different. But the Hyperloop between here and Columbia and Kansas City, no. $300 million just to put together a prototype, and that doesn't even put a fraction of it together in practical use. No, thank you. I don't want to be the one in the state to have to spend all that money for something that won't be used or ever be completed.
Years ago, the state of Florida, they went to put one in there, and of course, the deal was the federal government pays for the train, but then you have to maintain and operate it. And the state of Florida said, "No thanks." So, once in a while, government does things that are sensible.
If this somehow handicaps us in a way where we will get disqualified for government funds if we decide to put this through, this is a big blessing in disguise, because now we just dodged a bullet again. Tom Sullivan, people can look you up, but I got to say, thank you so much for making some time for us on Overnight America. I know you keep a close eye on government spending. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Ryan.
And he joins us on the TDK Technologies guest line on Overnight America KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
Okay, Overnight America continues. Yeah, thanks to Patrick who called in, and Patrick is right. I mean, they have had those debates. How in the world can you justify spending an extra $1 million a year on this thing that no one uses? Well, very few people use, we'll put it that way, when you could be spending that sort of money when on security, which is necessary for Metrolink. Now, that has been brought up many of times, and it's a very valid concern. The impeachment trial of Donald Trump continues, and today there was this thing that happened. A leakage of some of a book of John Bolton came out, and I think a lot of the Democrats jumped on it immediately to try to point out this is going to be the bombshell that changes everything. Could it be finally the thing? I wonder how much of this is orchestrated. It's weird, the timing of when this comes out. You know, President Trump will be very quick to say that, hey, it's not a coincidence that pre-sales for his book start today. Here's President Trump.
Still haven't seen a manuscript, but I can tell you nothing was ever said to John Bolton, but I have not seen a manuscript. I guess he's writing a book. I have not seen it.
Yeah, it's probably a way to help promote. And, you know, that's the thing. Of all of the different names that have come out in the past, John Bolton may be the most credible of them all, and maybe the one type of person where you'd listen to it and put some weight behind what he is saying. And that, I think, is going to be the significance of what was said in this book. So what do we know? What is addressed in this book? Well, how about we look at that? Here's what we know. The Republicans are very leery right now of the idea of calling no witnesses, because they say we should at least hear from Bolton. Is this an orchestrated attack? It may be. I think a lot of Republicans are, like the Mitt Romneys of the world, are more interested in hearing from him now than they were before. Chuck Schumer, for example.
And now, according to the New York Times, Ambassador Bolton wrote in his book that he was ordered by the president to continue freezing assistance until Ukraine announced the political investigations the president was seeking, including the investigation into the Bidens. This is stunning. It goes right to the heart of the charges against the president. Ambassador Bolton essentially confirms the president committed the offenses charged in the first article of impeachment.
Okay. And I think that's why you see in Alan Dershowitz going up and making the case that you could put these articles together, but it is not a cause of impeachment still. So even if this were the groundwork that was laid out in the future, it still doesn't rise to the level, nor does it even begin to justify the political ramifications or the way that they have been approaching the impeachment to begin with. So John Bolton, as according to the book, which we still don't know exactly what's in it, had a few things. So it says, at least according to the New York Times, who saw the manuscript, Trump told Bolton in August of 2019 that he would not release military aid to the Ukraine until they investigated the Bidens in claims of trying to interfere with the 2016 election in favor of Hillary Clinton. Bolton warned White House lawyers that he feared Giuliani was using his work with the president to help his private clients. A couple of things that were brought up there. Says here, Pompeo told Bill Barr that he was mentioned in the July call with Zelensky. The Justice Department claims Barr did not know that until mid-August. All right. I wanted to talk about this book, and I didn't exactly know the best way to approach it. But in general, I don't think this changes anything, because right now, as they lay out a defense for the articles of impeachment, the Republicans had the last couple of days, and they still have the time on the Senate floor. They don't have to directly question this right now, because it wasn't something that was brought up in particular. Like, it wasn't brought up. So it'd be almost like the Republicans, if they were to address this, it would be giving extra time to the Democrats, who are using the media in order to leak these things out, in order to try to add on and pile on other points that they did not include in their time. So you would be arguing against something that wasn't brought up to be argued with. Greg Gutfeld on The Five had a pretty good point.
We don't know who leaks it. We know why. The timing tells you why. This is in order to, like, to nail the president. But the thing I don't understand is nobody's actually seen the actual quote.
Because so I think it could actually defend him.
Well, I mean, here's the deal. People are freaking out on the right about this, and I'm going, like, it vindicates Trump, because he's telling everybody what Trump really thought, which was that Ukraine was corrupt, and he was on behalf of the Dems, and this is what he's trying to do. But now this is just like another bombshell. The media has TBD, terminal bombshell disease. A belch is a bombshell, but it's nothing. But the bottom line is nobody knows what it is.
All right, so that's part of it. Why in the world would they put this out the day that they're looking for pre-orders on the book? And that's the thing. When it comes to Bolton, he doesn't strike me as one of those individuals that would use this as a way to sell some books. He really doesn't. If this is all orchestrated this way, which, you know, it could very well be, it would be very disappointing. So what does this do for the impeachment moving forward? I don't know if it does anything other than gives Chuck Schumer a couple of extra things to point out when he's in front of a camera, because he's been saying the same things over and over and over again. He's going to try to use it as a way to try to pressure some of the candidates in the Republican side that may be viable when it comes to reelection in their own districts. You know, let's use this as another political tool, which really it's par for the course. If you're just going to try to put this out there and use the media on your side, as they have been, the mainstream media, the CNNs, the MSNBCs, and even the major three networks that air news nightly, the ABCs, the CBSs, and the NBCs, yeah, you're playing right to them in this. You're allowing that to be the extra, like, you know, you're getting a little extra bonus by allowing them to put this out there over and over again. I don't know if this will cause Bolton to testify. I think, if anything, this would be their one trick too. But I think the Republicans are going to stand pretty strong on the idea that if it leads to that, they are definitely going to call Hunter Biden in, because then they're going to have to 100% prove the point that there was funny business going on there, which it is warranted to investigate, which warrants the concern by the president. There has to be the Hunter Biden to show. And I don't think they want that. So they're going to, this is what I think is going to happen, and I may be wrong on this. I think the Democrats are going to continue to try to bang that drum as if they really want to have Bolton testify. But deep down inside, they're not going to push for it, because they know it's going to be more damaging for them bringing the Bidens in than it would be to let Bolton testify at this point. They would rather have the impression that Bolton would be there as this sort of scapegoat, that if he was going to testify, things would have been different. It's their backup plan. It's their way to justify a loss with these impeachment articles. They're just going to play it up that way. But in reality, they really don't want that to happen. I don't know. If I was the Republicans at this point, if I were able to bring in the Bidens, you would know this would be a bigger play. I think the president's been pretty consistent. If there is a subpoena, you know, going through the court, bringing them in an honest type of way, then if you want to open the floodgates, we're going to play this game. That would be more beneficial to them. I would continue to mention that. I would continue to bring that out into the public and say they don't want Bolton. This is their way of trying to save face, because they have a losing hand. And they really don't want him to testify because, one, it's not going to really bring anything to their case in the end. And two, it's going to open up our ability to defend this even further, which they don't want to happen. So I feel like they are really treading on dangerous grounds here. 314-436-7900 is the number, or 800-925-1120. With this Bolton book coming out, does this move the needle at all? Or is this for you change anything? I don't think it really does. This is Overnight America, KMOX.
News Radio 1120, KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
Welcome back to Overnight America. You know, it's interesting the way the Republicans approach today with Alan Dershowitz, the closer on the night that ended right before 8 o'clock our time. You find that the argument is, What is the constitutional application here for impeachment? So you have, for the last couple of days and last week, the Democrats lay out their case of why they don't like Donald Trump. But what's the constitutional application of it all? And I think Alan Dershowitz today, I wanted to play this for you.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters recently put it more succinctly in the context of a presidential impeachment. Here's what she said. Impeachment is whatever Congress says it is. There is no law. But this lawless view would place Congress above the law. It would place Congress above the Constitution. For Congress to ignore the specific words of the Constitution itself and substitute its own judgments would be for Congress to do what it is accusing the president of doing. And no one is above the law, not the president and not Congress.
Wow. Isn't that... He makes a strong case, and it should be one that is going to be listened to. And I think that when you have the Republicans that are mostly sitting there listening to this and not playing with fidget spinners or eating chocolate from Hershey's, who made a nice little candy delivery for them, or stretching or whatever it is, I think that they will look at this and say, now, if this were a regular trial, I think the judge would have had to speak to the jury and point out a few different things. This is what your job is. And I think the Democrats, leading up into this point with their arguments, have been arguing something that the Republicans knew that they didn't have to defend what they are arguing. They just have to defend what Alan Dershowitz sets up, what is impeachable, what isn't. And even in this case, the evidence would suggest, or at least historically speaking, this is not something that would rise to that occasion. Thus, it's all null and void. By the time it gets here, null and void. I don't know exactly what we'll do in the future when we look back at this time. I think a lot of people are going to take this as the divisive nature of politics, and maybe this could be one of those points where it's at its peak. I don't know if it'll ever back up from here. Or at least as long as President Trump is in office, I don't know if it'll ever back off from there. I feel like that's how we're going to look at this. I don't think we're going to look at this as Donald Trump was a terrible guy and he deserved to be removed from office and he was corrupt and he was a dictator. And what else do the Democrats say? He's a Nazi and he's this and he's that and blah, 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 blah. You know, all the different buzzwords they try to use to get out there and really rile up their core. I don't think that's how we're going to look at this, historically speaking. I think when we go back and look at this, the paragraphs that'll be in the history books will say, and this was the peak of divisiveness in American politics. That's it. I think that's all they're going to do it. No one's going to analyze what CNN or MSNBC or Fox News had to say about this. I think they'll play a little bit of what Alan Dershowitz just said there. In the end, when President Trump is resolved from all of this and he gets to continue on to the election in 2020, I think in the end, if they actually look into what went down with the Bidens, I think they'll realize there was some merit there. And I think that'll equal out all of the other crazy, crazy rhetoric that we've seen up to this point. But, you know, there are some people that are biting into this. Like, here's Chuck Schumer. I think this is their hope right now.
If Senate Republicans are not going to vote to call Mr. Bolton and Mr. Mulvaney and the other witnesses now, if they're not going to ask for notes and emails, they're going to be part of the cover-up, too. Because we have this out in the open. It's up to 4 Senate Republicans, just 4 Senate Republicans, to ensure that John Bolton, Mick Mulvaney, Mr. Blair, and Mr. Duffy testify in the Senate trial.
We'll see what happens after these statements, if it's going to rise to that level. Like, here's Jay Sekulow.
We live in a constitutional republic where you have deep policy concerns and deep differences. That should not be the basis of an impeachment. Are we going to have every time there's a policy difference of significance or an approach difference of significance about a policy, we're going to start an impeachment proceeding?
That's a good point. And I think that's kind of what was going down with Ken Starr. You know, he goes out there and he speaks, and man, was he. This is primarily the takeaway from Ken Starr. Ah, he is so boring. Here, I'm just going to, I had a long piece of his speech here. I'm just going to find a middle ground. I'll just randomly click somewhere in there. All right, producer Alex, pick a number between 1 and 8. Just give me a random number. You 8? Okay, so I'll go to the 8-minute mark. You pick 8. All right, that's probably for the best that we don't have to spend too much time on this. All right, let's see. Where's this at? Okay, here's the 8-minute mark in the clip.
The process had to be bipartisan. Like war, impeachment is hell.
Oh, you got the money clip right there.
Or at least presidential impeachment is hell. Those of us who lived through the Clinton impeachment, including members of this body,
full well understand that a presidential impeachment is tantamount to domestic war, albeit, thankfully, protected by our beloved first.
All right, so that's just a couple of minutes randomly put in there. Hey, you picked a good spot in that clip. Ann Coulter laid it out the best. What did she say? She said, Ken Starr litigation strategy, torture the Senate with such an excruciatingly boring presentation that they cannot take another minute of this trial. Oh, man, ain't that the truth. Wow. But no, he said some pretty important things. I think the key to all of this will be Alan Dershowitz. It's funny to see all of the different left-leaning news agencies scramble to try to discredit Alan Dershowitz right now. They're having a hard time because, really, they're making himself look silly by doing that. Because I think most people that would watch that and say, constitutionally speaking, he's right on. And I wanted to play a couple of clips from Pam Bondi earlier. In fact, I had a whole section from Pam Bondi. And she spoke for about a half hour or so on Hunter Biden and really laid out the objections of why we should be looking into this and why the president would be justified to ask questions about Hunter Biden and the relationship that Joe Biden had when it came to the favors that he was receiving. So I'm going to play some of that for you next. And I think that was one of the key moments from today. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
You know, we don't have time to play all 10 minutes or even 30 minutes of Pam Bondi, but I got a couple minutes I can play here for you. And she was laying out a case which would justify looking into Hunter Biden. Not so much a coincidence, all of these things laying out. Let's start that. I think it's important to hear.
All three men, Hunter Biden, Devin Archer, and Chris Hines, had all started an investment firm together. Public records show that April 16th, 2014, Devin Archer meets with Vice President Biden at the White House. Just 2 days later, on April 18th, 2014, is when Hunter Biden quietly joins Burisma, according to public reporting. Remember, this is just 1 month after the United Kingdom's Serious Fraud Office opened a money laundering case into Burisma. Hunter Biden joins their board. And not only 10 days after Hunter Biden joins the board, British authorities seize $23 million in British bank accounts connected to the oligarch Zolchevsky, the owner of Burisma. Did Hunter Biden leave the board then? No. The British authorities also announced that it had started a criminal investigation into potential money laundering. Did Hunter Biden leave the board? No. What happened was then, only then, did the company choose to announce that Hunter Biden had joined the board after the assets of Burisma and his oligarch owner, Zolchevsky, were frozen and a criminal investigation had begun. Hunter Biden's decision to join Burisma raised flags almost immediately. One article from May 2014 stated, "The appointment of Joe Biden's son to the board of Ukrainian gas firm Burisma has raised eyebrows the world over." Even an outlet with bias for Democrats pointed out Hunter Biden's activities created a conflict of interest for Joe Biden. The article stated, "The move raises questions about a potential conflict of interest for Joe Biden." Now, even Chris Hines, Hunter Biden's own business partner, had grave concerns. He thought that working with Burisma was unacceptable. This is Chris Hines. He was worried about the corruption, the geopolitical risk, and how bad it would look. So he wisely distances himself from Hunter Biden and Devin Archer's appointments to Burisma. He didn't simply call his stepfather, Secretary of State, and say, I have a problem with this. He didn't tell his friends, hey guys, I'm not getting on the board. I want nothing to do with this. He went so far as to send an email to senior State Department officials about this issue. This is Chris Hines. He wrote, apparently, Devin and Hunter have joined the board of Burisma, and a press release went out today. I can't speak to why they decided to, but there is no investment by our firm in their company. What did Hunter Biden do? He stayed on the board. What did Chris Hines do? He subsequently stopped doing business with his college roommate, Devin Archer, and his friend, Hunter Biden. Chris Hines' spokesperson said, the lack of judgment in this matter was a major catalyst for Mr. Hines ending his business relationship with Mr. Archer and Mr. Biden. Now, the media also noticed. The same day, an ABC News reporter asked Obama White House Press Secretary Jay Carney about it. Here's what happened.
Hunter Biden has now taken a position with the largest oil and gas company, holding company in Ukraine. Is there any concern about at least the appearance of a conflict there? See the vice president.
I would refer you to the vice president's office. I saw those reports. You know, Hunter Biden and other members of the Biden family are obviously private citizens, and where they work is not does not reflect an endorsement by the administration or by the vice president or president, but I would refer you to the vice president's office.
The next day, the Washington Post ran a story about it. It said, the appointment of the vice president's son to a Ukrainian oil board looks nepotistic at best, nefarious at worst. Again, the appointment of the vice president's son to a Ukrainian oil board looks nepotistic at best, nefarious at worst. And the media didn't stop questioning, asking questions here. It kept going. Here's ABC.
You have to fight the cancer of corruption.
But then something strange happened. Just 3 weeks later, a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, accused of corruption, appoints Hunter Biden, seen here in their promotional videos, to their board of directors, paying his firm more than $1 million a year.
Here's more from ABC. Continued on.
And Ukraine wasn't the only country where Hunter Biden's business and his father's diplomacy as vice president intersected. It also happened in China.
This video shows Chinese diplomats greeting Vice President Biden as he arrived in Beijing in December of 2013. Right by his side, his son Hunter. Less than 2 weeks later, Hunter's firm had new business, creating an investment fund in China involving the government-controlled Bank of China, with reports they hope to raise $1.5 billion.
In fact, every witness who was asked about Hunter Biden's involvement with Burisma agreed there was a potential appearance of a conflict of interest. Multiple House Democrat witnesses, including those from the Department of State, the National Security Council, and others, unanimously testified there was a potential appearance of a conflict of interest. These were their witnesses. How much money did Hunter Biden get for being on the board? Well, you start looking at this bank records, according to reports, between April 2014 and October 2015, Burisma paid more than $3.1 million to Devin Archer and Hunter Biden. That's over the course of a year and a half. How do we know this? Some of Devin Archer's bank records were disclosed during an unrelated federal criminal case having nothing to do with Hunter Biden. These bank records show 17 months that Burisma wired two payments of $83,333, not just for 1 month, for 2 months, for 3 months, but for 17 months. According to Reuters, sources report that of the two payments of $83,333 each, one was for Hunter Biden and one Devin Archer. Now, Hunter Biden was paid significantly more than board members for major U.S. Fortune 100.
Oh, man, I wish I could play the rest of this. So this was part of the 30 minutes that Pam Bondi had today on the Senate floor. And I know that the networks ducked out of this. They spent a lot of time with Dershowitz, but they ducked out of what I thought was some of the most important reasoning of why we're in this mess to begin with. That's Pam Bondi. I'd encourage you to go check the whole speech out. It's Overnight America.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.